This podcast is sponsored by Kaplan Professional, the leading provider of online education for Australia's finance industry. Studying my Master of Applied Finance with Kaplan Professional provided me with the flexibility and support to deepen my specialist knowledge while balancing my professional commitments. If you're planning to sit the CFA exam, Kaplan Professional is also renowned for the most respected preparation materials in the industry. Visit kaplanprofessional.edu.au to learn more. Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of The Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the RASC Group's Financial Services Guide on the RASC Finance website. Tony Hansen is my guest for today's show. Tony founded EGP Capital, an Australian funds management business based in Sydney. I've been wanting to speak with Tony for a while because the way he thinks about investing and the management of money is unconventional and potentially disruptive. Tony's early life was filled with good luck, bad luck, hard work and skill. After finding himself with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt, Tony learned some hard lessons about business and money very early in life. Despite his success in more recent times, however, Tony is grounded, very humble, and generous with his time, and he has some great lessons to share. I hope you enjoy this episode with Tony Hansen of EGP Capital. So Tony, thanks for joining me on the show.
No problem. Good to be here.
Privileged to have you on the show. I've been a big fan of EGP for a long time and been following from a distance, so it's great to finally meet you in person and hear some of your insights. The typical way we start with the show is to track your journey and how you came to be in the position that you're in and start the business that you started.
Sure, it's pretty different to most people, I think.
It seems like it, so I'm very interested to get stuck into it. So you've graduated from high school in the 90s, and according to what I've read online, you deferred study to start a construction business.
Well, it was actually it was a family construction business. So effectively what happened was my father had something of a midlife crisis and ran the business into basically ran the ship aground. And rather than watch him go bankrupt, I decided to tell him to step aside. And being the cocky young 18-year-old that I was, that I decided that I could probably salvage it. And it was all at once, probably one of the worst and best things that I ever did. So the business was, which doesn't seem so significant now, but when you're 18, it was several hundred thousand dollars in debt and, wow, and really struggling, and you know, didn't have a lot of work pipeline. So it was a nursery construction business, so building hot houses, greenhouses, shading systems, benching systems, and you know, anything and everything to go with the construction of a nursery. And so I ground away for about 3 or 4 years at that, or 5 years, I guess it might have been, you know, gradually recovering the debt and earning very little. And then we sold out, or basically what happened was a business from Western Australia who was moving into the East Coast sort of came to work with me, and that ended up being another valuable lesson in terms of, I set up an agreement with those guys, which was a very, very low base salary, and which is how I almost always seem to set things up, with a very, very low base and a performance, and then we had a disagreement about a bunch of the work that was bought in the first year. There was a very large contract which I thought that I'd won, and they claimed that they'd won, and I looked into, after 12 months of working there, I learned a very valuable thing about reading and understanding a contract before you sign it, and I ended up walking away without really making very much out of that. So yeah, didn't really recover all of the debts, earned a very meager salary along the way, and then didn't really make that much on the sale of the business.
Sounds like a very humble beginning to business life, and inheriting that debt from your parents.
Yeah, well, it was a pretty humble beginning. That whole most of I always describe most of the lessons I learned from my parents were counterpoint lessons, so lessons learned in what not to do. So my parents weren't very good at saving or sort of investing or looking after after their financial well-being. And so that became something that was important to me to never ever end up in that situation. So which is a big part of the intellectual underpinnings of how I came to be, I guess, so focused on setting myself up financially to make sure that I was never at risk like that.
It's certainly a unique journey through business. Not many people jump in the deep end with both feet. Normally they test it out or they have a bright idea. But let's jump forward a bit. So you've sold the business. You've had your study deferred for a while now, and you decided to go back and pursue a career in finance, presumably because you were enrolled in the...
I was originally enrolled in a commerce degree, and I actually went back and started at University of New England doing a degree by distance education. Mm-hmm. And I started initially as a economics degree, but maybe in second or third semester along, I sort of decided that economics sort of narrows your field of options down a lot more, and I decided to switch to a commerce degree, which sort of widens out your range of potential outcomes from the education. So I was investing all the way along through there. To be fair, my wife and I were primarily focused, obviously, at that stage in my 20s on paying down. We had a mortgage debt, so almost all of our income went to raising children and paying down that debt. But I was always interested in the markets. I've always been interested in business, obviously running a business from the time I was 18, and I ran businesses all through my teenage years as well. We grew up on a farm, so I'd set up, if we were growing flowers, I'd set up a stall on the road. There was a road 5 kilometres down, so I'd ride my bike down with flowers and sell them on the roadside. I always had a sort of an entrepreneurial streak, I guess, in terms of business, so I was always interested in business.
That's great. What type of flowers?
Chrysanthemums for Mother's Day. So, but yeah, we grew all sorts of stuff. Baby's breath and dahlias, all sorts of different flowers along the way. We also grew vegetables and so on, but never very successfully. It wasn't a commercial farm. I grew up on 30 acres, so it was more of a hobby farm than anything.
You and I share something in common, growing up on a flower farm and going down the local street and selling something until I got in trouble with the council for not having a permit.
Well, I never got in trouble with the council, so...
Perhaps I was doing too well. So you studied the commerce degree. Were you influenced by any books, or were there any particular mentors that you clung to?
At that stage, so at the stage where I was still studying, I really wasn't doing all that much investing. My journey to investing started probably in the early 2000s, so around that 2000, 2001 when I sold the business. And mm-hmm. So we started to do some modest investing. And I guess at that stage I started to read. I came across the Buffett and Munger and the Peter Lynch and all of that sort of stuff that people seem to traditionally find early on when they invest. But none of that had a really big impact at that stage, because I just didn't have the capital to do very much at that stage. And I was just focused on, I was working 3 jobs while I was putting myself through university. Didn't have a huge amount of spare time for reading, so I was working as a I was running a hotel, working as a bouncer, and also doing scaffolding. So those 3 jobs sort of kept my days filled.
I can imagine. Mm. So you've graduated with the degree, and then you've taken a job at UGL, is that correct?
Yeah. So Andrew Phipps, who's currently the CFO of RCR Tomlinson, actually recruited me to UGL back in the day in 2007, and so I started working on a project down there. I worked a little bit in head office for a while, just sort of learning the ropes, and then I moved out to a project at North Head Sewage Treatment Plant, a project called, it was referred to as the PAR project. It was a renewal and rejuvenation of the facility, basically. It was,
And what were you doing?
I was running the project accounting.
Okay, great. So you were able to apply probably some of the principles that you learned at school, presumably, econometrics?
Yeah, I mean, all of the... what I did in the degree was directly applicable to what I was doing, but more than anything, I think my own... my own thrifty nature, I sort of did a little bit of the what you would call, you know, some of the acquisition and so on, did a lot of the buying and setting up of the early stage of the project. So I set up all of the site sheds and we, you know, did a lot of buying of forklifts and some sort of major equipment in the early part of that project, and that I quite enjoyed because it enabled me to, you know, negotiate and to do deals, and which is a part of what I like. But I also ran the P&L for the project and all of the back end accounting for it as well. So I had a good diverse range of experiences that were quite good.
Yeah. So this was all in the lead up to what would ultimately become the GFC. How did you position? Were you investing in the share market at this time?
I was. Yeah. So we'd more or less paid our house off by 2007. So
how old were you?
I would have been 30. By then. So to be fair, my wife and I were never earning big money. That first job I took at UGL was for a $47,000 base salary. I was pretty quickly earning, you know, a bit more than that when they figured out that I wasn't too bad at what I was doing. But it was several years into my career beyond that point before I ever earned a six-figure salary and actually had. So there was a lot of pretty brutal scrimping and saving involved in how I got to the point where I had, I guess, the financial capability of investing in the market and having had the house paid off. So I used to do a lot of, my wife gave me a lot of free rein with our finances, to be fair, but I would do things like I would buy our cars at auction and sell them within sort of 18 months. And usually for about the price that I'd paid. And what I was doing by doing that was actually removing depreciation from my lifestyle. So, you know, depreciation is one of the things that really keeps middle class families being able to get ahead. You know, you buy a $30,000 car and sell it 5 years later for $12,000 or something. That's a big slice out of your disposable income. So I was always looking for ways to minimize those types of harms. And so although we didn't ever have, my wife and I, say between the ages that I met her at 20 and say by 30, through that 10 years, my total earnings and her total earnings would have been less than the median income of the average Australian family, but we still managed to save or pay off a mortgage just by really being very, very disciplined.
And that focus on personal finance and getting your expenses as low as possible didn't have an impact on your overall happiness, or?
I think that material goods people overrate for happiness. I still, to this day, although I could afford much nicer things now, don't really spend all that much on material goods. It's one of Buffett sayings that I quite like about the chains of habit being too light to be felt until they're too heavy to be broken. The same things apply to good habits as bad habits. So if you can force yourself to be thrifty, and not to the point of being painful, I'm still generous with friends and first to put my hand in my pocket when it's time to buy a shout at the pub and that sort of thing. But and the way I used to think about it through that period, I always thought about when I started investing more seriously, probably through 2006 and 2007, as we got to the end of having our house paid off, I started to think about each dollar of capital that I would spend as... And you can do the compounding yourself. So I was about 30 years old, but I'd think of that dollar as $1,000 that I wouldn't have when I was 80. So which is sort of a low teens compounding expectation with what I could do with the capital. So I'd sit there, and if I'm about to buy a cup of coffee for $3.50, I think that's $3,500 I won't have when I'm 80 years of age. And is it worth it to me now? And it's a way of deciding whether the happiness that the expenditure is going to bring you is worth the sacrifice of what you won't have.
Fantastic way to look at it. We all can't do the math in the head, but I think that's you can remember that.
Well, it's 10 years later now, so it's not quite so expensive each thing.
So this the GFC hits and things, financial markets more or less move into a bit of a panic. How did you position yourself? And perhaps you can reflect on your time running a business and your knowledge of accounting and maybe draw on some of those behavioural biases and how you combated them.
Sure. So I think contrarianism is a natural instinct that as much as you might try to train it, I think that some people who are prone to running towards the fire or investing when financial markets are plummeting, those people I don't think you might be able to get better at it, but I don't, you know, it's something you've either got or you haven't to some extent. And I consider my ability to stay calm in a situation of panic to be probably a couple of standard deviations better than average. So I should point out that we got very lucky through 2007 as well. So we sold a house in Newcastle, which was more or less at the top of the Newcastle housing cycle, and we bought into Sydney in 2008. A few months later, which was more or less at the bottom of the Sydney housing cycle. People don't think that the Sydney housing cycle ever had a flat period, but I actually paid the same price for the townhouse that I live in as the original owner bought it off the plan for in the year 2000. So I paid, I might have been $2,000 or $3,000 more. It was very close to the original price that the owner paid. And we had some quite good fortune in terms of that, but we paid cash for that house, and so that all of our disposable income through the rest of 2007 or 2008 got put into the investing steadily. And then we had some more good fortune in terms of come the day that Lehman Brothers went into bankruptcy. I think it was in September 2008. I said to my wife, "This is a one-off opportunity, potentially a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity." I said, "Will you allow me to borrow money against the house?" And so my wife allowed me to take a $300,000 line of credit against our home.
That wouldn't have been easy.
And the wonderful thing about it was is that the banks took so long to process the application. I think it took probably upwards of 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks. And the whole time the market was cratering. So we had some considerable good fortune in liquidating all of our assets to pay cash for a house in early 2008, and then only having limited capital to use in the market through 2008. And then that luck was compounded by borrowing. And we probably got that money in either late October or early November, and saved for about $10,000 or $15,000 of headroom. I finished deploying that capital in February 9th, 2009. So it was almost a month to the day before the market bottomed. So I put a fairly substantial, relative to our net worth at the time, amount of capital to work, and we had a really, really spectacular 2009 in terms of the growth in the family net worth.
Do you remember, can you draw on any specific examples? You don't have to name names, but can you, what you were seeing in terms of the opportunities that were in front of you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had probably, by February 2009, I think I had probably 30% of our net worth in listed investment companies. So I haven't owned one almost for, I would say, probably the last 7 years. But at that time, because one of the funny things that happens in when financial markets dislocate like that is that people sell assets below what they're worth. And so the whole share market was quite cheap. You could have thrown a dart. This is what I was saying to people I was working with at that stage. You could almost throw a dart at the shares pages, and the chances of buying something that wouldn't have done quite well over the next 3 or 4 years was pretty low. But then you also had this opportunity to buy. I was buying LICs, listed investment companies, at prices I was paying high 60 cents in the dollar and the good thing about doing that is you could look through their assets and you could make an assessment as to whether you liked the portfolio. And if you liked the portfolio and you would have been happy to own those stocks, you could then buy those stocks for 35% less than you could buy the equivalent portfolio at market. So it was a really wonderful opportunity. So that was where almost one third of our capital went. And then we had some holdings in miners and so on, which we certainly wouldn't have. Well, we very rarely buy miners with EGP. We've only ever owned one or two. Yeah, we owned a few mining stocks. So I bought MacArthur Coal at maybe $2.40 a share, and I think it got bought out at $17 a share within about 18 months. But we were doing things like we were spending a lot of time buying discounted rights issues. So we bought Wes Farmers discounted rights issue, and I bought Macquarie Bank. So it was across the board. It was everything from small caps. There was the opportunity set, obviously, in early 2009 was unlike anything I've ever seen.
This action you took, fortuitous luck and skill, I suppose, combination of the two, 2 years later, EGP is formed.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of my friends and family observed, I guess, my behaviour through that period, and the fact that my wife and I went from being, very, very regular middle-class people to having actually a nest egg, and it was all done in a relatively short period. And a lot of people said, how can I do that? And I spent time around that time, through 2010, a lot of people started to ask me about, you know, what they could do in terms of investing. We're asking for share tips, which I've always been reluctant as a general rule to give anyway, because I always say if you tell someone two stocks, there's no question they'll buy one of them. It'll be the one that does poorly out of the two. But I looked around at managed funds, and I sort of saw an industry that didn't operate in the way that I thought that industry should operate. I thought it would be very easy to find a fund that had a very, very low base fee, and the majority of the fund manager's earnings were delivered by outperformance, and there was nothing like that. And I had an ambition to one day run money myself, and so I thought I might be able to use – there were 16 people that originally started. So what happened in 2011 was we created Eternal Growth Partners, and there was $400,000 of my wife's money and $80,000, which was $5,000 each from 16 investors. That was the initial capital. And then over the next probably 2 or 3 years, I slowly, because it was painful to pay all of that capital gains tax, but I slowly liquidated all of our outside holdings, my wife and mine, and migrated them into the fund, and those original group of people added to their holdings as well. And we grew very quickly. We're probably $1.5 million within 12 months, and we basically grew it at about maybe 100% per annum roughly for the first six years.
Fantastic. You didn't set up this fund as what we would traditionally call a managed fund. Is that correct?
No. So we used one of the things that's difficult about starting a small fund is there's a huge amount of cost and compliance. So because it was all friends and family money and people who knew and trusted me, I set up a company structure, which is a very, very low cost way to pool money. The only downside really to it is you don't get the capital gains tax discount for holdings longer than 12 months. So you just pay normal company tax rates. But then I just pass that through as franked dividends anyway, so it's not a huge disadvantage. But basically set that up, and under the small scale offerings rules of the Section 708 of the Corporations Act legislation, you can take on up to 20 investors and up to $2 million of retail money without issuing a prospectus. So it's a way to sort of pool capital at relatively low cost. It costs $243 a year, I think, to have an ASIC registered company fund, and then I got externally audited, which just so that I had an arm's length taxation and confirmation of what the asset values were. And so in total, you can pull it off for less than $2,000 when you're running it very small. We're paying more like $4,000 for taxation and audit by the end when we're running 14 or 15 million. But even still, it was costing $4,500 to run that $15 million fund, which is pretty cheap.
It's incredible considering the cost of doing it otherwise.
Yeah, the costs are pretty brutal for more traditional structures.
I'm hoping now we can shift a little bit of focus and to the company that you've built. You mentioned briefly that you looked around the industry. Typical fee structures are such that you pay a base fee, say, between 1% and 2%, and there may be a performance fee for the manager if they do particularly well. You'd hope that's over some sort of benchmark, whether that's a fixed 5%, 10%, whatever. One of the quotes that's on your website relates to architects in ancient Rome and how they built archways, and the first person to stand beneath it was the engineer.
From Seth Klarman's Margin of Safety. So the engineer actually stood underneath it as they pulled the scaffold off, and that was what Seth says is his concern for the quality of the arch was intensely personal. It's not so surprising that so many arches survive to this day. So that's one of the other. So there are probably three key things that I explain to investors if they're looking for a managed fund or an investor to invest their money. And the arch is important. So I think that the arch metaphor, it describes the fact that the fund manager should have a substantial proportion of their own wealth inside the fund. My view is that at least 50% of a fund manager's net worth should be inside the fund, unless they're doing something really esoteric. If someone was to set up a Bitcoin fund or something crazy like that, then that would be madness to have 50% of your net worth in that. But for someone who's setting up a fund that's a broad-based fund that can do almost anything that fund manager wants to do in terms of growing the fund, they should have substantially all of their investable assets in it, according to me.
And that's purely to keep their interests
to ensure that their interests are aligned. So one of the great risks I tell people is that if I'm a fund manager and I've got a couple of $1 million of my own net worth, which I'm doing something with over on the side here, and I've got a fund, might be a couple of $100 million worth of client assets, well, my interests in taking care of your assets may be outweighed by the fact that if I can hit a 50% gangbuster year this year and earn a big performance fee, well, I'll do very well out of that. But if I blow that fund up, that's okay, because I've got my money set off over to the side here. So it provides investors with an important protection that you know that the fund manager isn't going to be swinging for the fences without taking some downside risk themselves. So
one thing that we're seeing at the moment is a lot of pressure on fees, particularly as passive investing takes a hold. We're seeing more flows into low fee index funds, the emergence of smart beta. Can you explain your fee structure and how, perhaps relative to other funds, be they active or passive, where you see the value proposition?
So we don't charge a fee at all. So the fund will recover its operating costs, which now that we're in a unit trust, it's 21 basis points to our administrator. And then there's a few other costs, things like audit and some custody fees, which maybe amount to a few basis points more. But if we don't beat our benchmark, which is the ASX 200 Total Return Index, then we don't earn a fee at all, which unfortunately happened last year for the first time in 7 years. And so we finally had to pay the price for structuring things that way. But according to me, that's the most honest way for a fund manager to structure it. I mean, it doesn't have to be that benchmark. It could be whatever benchmark you set out in advance. But if you don't deliver to that, then you shouldn't earn a fee. And one of the other, I said there are three protections that I'd look for in a fund manager. One of them is that the fund manager should have the financial wherewithal, that they don't rely on the income out of the fund necessarily as their primary, or is it, you know, they don't require it necessarily to get by day to day, is pretty important, because that will change the way that someone invests as well. People should be investing from a more relaxed position with a longer term view, I think.
So given that the income that you generate and presumably the wage that you would draw from the business, does that necessitate holding a cash balance on the side?
So that line of credit that I drew, that I created in 2008 in the GFC, is still available to me. So okay. I've kept it there. You just never know when the GFC might come along. And for the cost of, I think it cost me $330 a year to have that facility there. And it's actually got a much larger, because the value of our home is, thanks to the Sydney property market, is roughly twice what it was 10 years ago. The value of that facility is higher, and that sits there available for me. So I've got access to capital should I require it. And to be frank, I think that my wife also earns a pretty respectable income now, and our children finished costing money. So our daughter's in university now, but the boys are both in work and don't rely on us so much financially. So we really have very, very minimal financial needs, which is a consequence of all of those years of thriftiness, is that our operating costs, we own everything that we need to. We don't have any finance on vehicles or anything like that. So our running costs for our life are actually pretty meagre.
Yep, sounds very simple but efficient. Let's move across to your investment process and philosophy. I read in an interview on Guru Focus, I believe it was, you described your investment process and philosophy as glacial, and that stuck out to me. We'll dig into the specifics in just a moment, but perhaps you can provide a high-level view of what you're trying to achieve at EGP.
So all we want to do is to... Then this sounds a little bit flippant, but we're just trying to grow our assets as fast as we can whilst taking on the least amount of risk possible. That should be basically every fund manager's aim. But we hope in markets that over the long run operate as they have, we would hope to earn a mid-double-digit return over time. I often say to people when they're thinking about compounding, it's one of the things that they should teach more carefully in school, is that if you can compound your money at 15% per annum, which it has to be said is a high rate of return, but your money doubles every 5 years, quadruples in 10, grows 16-fold in 20 years, you can do pretty miraculous things if you can get and even at 10% per annum, you're doubling roughly every 7 and a bit years, quadrupling in 14 and roughly in 20 years, you're growing 8-fold if you can get 10% per annum. So anything that's in the double digits is going to ensure that a relatively modest amount of money now becomes a very large amount of money. And so what we're trying to do in simple terms is to just find investments where we can take on relatively modest risk, but still earn a respectable rate of return, you know, which I would define as in normal markets, which is where the markets earn, say, between 5 and 8% annualised, is a return in the double digits, so just to do better than that.
Reading through your content, and I suppose this comes back to the comment about Glacial, but you've held positions for up to a decade, is that correct?
Our largest position in the fund is United Overseas Australia, which I first bought in 2008, so yeah, that's been a decade. And it's just as cheap today as it was when I, well, it's maybe not quite as cheap as it was when I bought it first in 2008, but it's still very cheap. Our average holding period is we turn over through the first 7 years we've operated the fund, and I didn't track my turnover quite so closely when I was investing in my own account, but it probably would have been relatively similar, although through the GFC there was probably a bit more movement. We were selling things that were cheap to buy stuff that was cheaper, but basically we've turned over about 12.5% of our fund annually for the first 7 years, and that turnover is measured as total sales over the average size of the fund each year, so that implies more like an eight year turnover, and that's broken up into two parts. So we invest with a very high concentration in our best 10 or 15 ideas, and with a longer tail that runs out, and so our turnover in the ideas outside of our top 10 would be much higher than it is inside of our top 10, but those top 10 ideas, for the most part, I think that you'd be surprised if in 5 years seven of those 10 we didn't still hold in the portfolio, barring some unusual valuation. If the value of something gets well beyond what's fair value, we'll sell it, obviously. But if you own a good business that's performing well and doesn't and isn't grossly overvalued, then generally it's better to hold those businesses.
Yeah, I suppose that it comes back to that old saying that we're all taught when we're younger is buy low, sell high. What it seems you can do is buy low and allow that business to compound and not be in any particular rush to sell it.
Well, that's what we try to do, obviously. It is tricky, and all of the usual pressures. The intrinsic value of a business will rarely move by more than, say, a really good business could grow its intrinsic value at maybe 25% per annum if it's a real cracking business. You'll find that even the majority of good businesses will struggle to compound their intrinsic value at more than 10 or 15% per annum. But circulating around that, the majority of stocks will have a swing of at least 40% from their high to their low in any 12-month period. So, and if their value is only going up by 10 to 15%, then there's obviously an opportunity presented there. So that's not to say that we won't occasionally trim something that we think's got a little bit ahead of itself and then buy it again when it gets lower. But one obvious exception to that is we've never ever sold a single share of United Overseas. I've only ever bought that stock. So I've only ever bought it when it gets cheaper. I've never sold it. So
from the outside, it looks like you would have a thick skin, and I think that's we've talked about that, and it's been borne out through your experience in the GFC. 50% of your positions, or 50% of the fund, is invested in 5 investment ideas or thereabouts, and 80% of the top 10.
Yeah,
how do you find the balance between holding your conviction and being overconfident?
I guess the conviction to do that just comes in believing in yourself. You have to be confident. Investing is a quite an arrogant profession in some senses, is that you have to believe that you know more about a business than the broader market does. Otherwise, why would you be buying it? So anytime you buy something, there's an inherent arrogance in that you have to be confident that you know better than the market does. So you need to be confident. You need to have thick skin, and you will have usually in a concentrated portfolio like we have, you'll have pretty big swings. And we've been on the receiving end of it's actually been our worst period the last quarter in the 7 and a bit years that we've operated, is that we were ahead of the market at the end of March, and we closed the year 10.6% behind the market. So we declined by a few percent over the last quarter. The market exploded higher, and you have to, if you're going to take the concentrated positions that we do, you have to have the stomach to withstand that, and the confidence that what you're doing is right and that eventually you'll come back.
And just to explain to listeners, this is a really good point to make, is that with the way the fund is set up, you only benefit financially if you reach a higher point than the market has, is that correct?
That's right. So our return has to be positive and outperforming the market, otherwise we don't earn anything.
So effectively you're paying because you've underperformed for this one period.
So basically, on the first $50 million that we manage, we earn 20% outperformance, and everything above $50 million, we earn 15% outperformance. So effectively, you could say, you know, we're running about $56 million at the moment, so our fee's about 19% or thereabout of outperformance. We started July 10.6% behind, so you can effectively say that that first 10.6% that I earn, you're going to avoid 2% of fees.
That's incredible.
And we're already, so far in July at least, we look like we're going to clip a couple of percent back, so the comeback has begun, hopefully.
Like you said, intellectually honest, I don't know many fund managers that would put himself in a position like that. So,
yeah, well, I think I talked in my annual letter this year about Manish Parbhai, who at the Daily Journal annual meeting, which Charlie Munger chairs, Charlie called him out because in 2008 he runs a fund that's modelled off Buffett's original partnerships, which is a zero management fee, 6% hurdle, 25% of outperformance of anything above that. He was negative, I think it might have been as much as 40% in 2008. And it's taken him 10 years of earning back all of that 48% plus the 6% annual hurdle on top of that before he's actually earned a fee. So it took 10 years for him to earn that back.
Not many people will be willing to work 10 years for...
There's not too many around. This is why I say one of the things that your fund manager should be is independently wealthy to the extent that they are not relying on the income of the fund. Otherwise, it can distort decision-making. So, your fund manager should be independently wealthy, preferably.
Mm. So, you have a reasonably compact team. How do you source new ideas, and do you use perhaps... filtering techniques, and how do you focus your time and energy on only the best small Australian companies?
So we, by compact team, it really is just me. Obviously, fund host run all of the back end for my fund now. But as far as the investment decisions, I make all of those within the fund. So I consider the fund to be sort of like my own family office with just some other people's money attached to it. And so that's part of the reason I've got all of my investable wealth in it. Mm. But as to sourcing new ideas, so we've got about almost 300 people inside the fund now. And we have a lot of very smart investors inside the fund. I get a lot of ideas coming directly to me from my own investor group. Encourage communication. It's one of the good things about being a small fund manager. And people think that it's almost 300 investors, the communicating with them would be difficult. But, I get a couple of emails a day. It's not that hard to keep up with. And for the small sacrifice of doing that, every now and again, I get an idea that's really useful. I work in an office with a couple of other funds that run on a similar philosophy to me. So we share ideas. You know, if we each go to a different meeting one day, we come back and debrief on the meeting each one went to. And as far as filtering, I do use some filters. So one of the challenges I set myself is to try and look at the market in a different way every week or two, to try and come up with a new way of thinking about filtering that I haven't done before. So a recent one that I did was looking for businesses with very, very high depreciation charges, for example, relative to their market capitalization or relative to their earnings. And so that these businesses might be businesses that have very low or even negative statutory earnings, but because of high depreciation charges might actually be generating positive cash. So you just got to try and think about, you know, when there's all of these, we talked offline about algorithmic trading and artificial intelligence and this sort of thing. When you've got everyone looking at things, all of the same ideas, thinking about low price to earnings ratio or low EV to EBITDA ratios is only going to get you so far when there's a bunch of machines that have been trained to find that stuff much better than you can. So you've got to try and think about something that a machine might not be thinking about, or just a way of coming up with ideas that very few other people are looking at. So
do you think that when we hear a lot of the headlines as investors that value investing is dead, or we hear value is dead, growth is outperforming? I mean, standard price to book, price to earnings, they're very easily to automate. Do you think there's still a place for value investing?
Oh, I don't. I think that the way that people think about value investing is sort of wrong. They think mechanically about low price to book ratios, low price to earnings ratios, but there's a bit more to it than that. And so value investing certainly has been changed by the big tech companies. You know, so companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon are earning very high returns on capital relative to their tangible assets, which is very different to the businesses that operated, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Businesses like manufacturers and so on, which had huge tangible capital committed. So you do have to be constantly changing as the market changes to how you think about what value is. But the idea of finding something, an investment that's capable of earning more cash flow over the next 5 or 6 years than its current market cap is, and doesn't have a huge need for that cash and can return that cash to shareholders or alternatively reinvest that cash, that is and will always exist. But certainly over the last 10 years, using those traditional price to book and price to earnings ratios, value investing has been trounced by growth investing, because all of these tech companies, even on our own exchange, there are companies like WiseTech Global and Afterpay and these sorts of things that are more based on ideas than tangible assets. They're the ones that are really performed.
Yeah, the goodwill associated with those brands is certainly run a long race. When you find these opportunities and the company that you're willing to dig a little bit deeper into, how do you go about valuing them?
So this always sounds a little bit flippant as well when I say it, but in simple terms, what I'm looking for is I need to convince myself that before I put a dollar into an idea, that I can earn at least 20% annually on that dollar. And to be fair, we haven't earned 20% annually, so I'm not doing that great of a job. But the idea is that if you are persuaded that the midpoint of your valuation range earns you a 20% rate of return annually, and that can be depending on the investment. So I tend to use internal rate of return. So if I come across an idea that I thought I might only hold for 6 months, and as much as we do have that track record of long ownership, if I found one of our holdings at the moment is in a property investment called APN Regional Property Fund, which is a property fund that's currently trading at about $1.17. It's got net tangible assets in the $1.30 range and the potential for a slight upgrade. And there's a liquidation or management of promise to liquidate by the 31st of December. And so our IRR on that, if it closes by December and sort of gets the price that we expect, will be in the 30 to 40% range. But you know, we'll have only held it for less than a year, and it's a shorter term proposition. So when I'm buying something for the longer term, you know, in simple terms, if I'm looking to own something for at least 5 years, I want to be able to make 20% per annum for 5 years. And so the reason I picked that number is because I'm aiming for a sort of a mid-teens return in the fund over time. And, you know, targeting 20% allows me to make mistakes and still get 15. And so in simple terms, we try to buy when we think we've got more than 20% internal rate of return. We generally try to sell when that gets to a single digit. And so that allows us a swing range and allows us some room whereby we don't sort of chop and change our ideas too much.
Do you think the time you spent studying econometrics and, relatively speaking, in infrastructure and projects, obviously IRR is a very popular technique there. Do you think you leverage some of that?
I think that everything you do as a person will shape somehow how you behave as an investor. So almost everything, and certainly your employment is a key part of what frames you. You know, by the time you've been in the workforce for 10 or 15 years, a lot of what you've experienced in the workplace will, I guess, shape the way that you invest. And so, yeah, definitely. I think about, you know, because I've had such a broad cross-section of experiences in a variety of businesses, it gives you just a slightly different angle to think about a company from than someone who's perhaps worked in finance all their life and never actually been operational. Mm-hmm. It certainly gives me a slightly better understanding. But you know, with that said, we don't really own all that much in infrastructure, and even in construction, we own a few construction businesses. But you know, it's not like I've really applied that advantage all that much. There are a few times when my work history has probably helped us out. So I've got some background in the electricity industry, and we've had a couple of investments around that industry. And as you know, I've got background in construction as well. So occasionally it gives you an advantage, and you've got to use whatever advantages you can get.
I'd like to quickly jump back to the business again. And you've now got, at June 30th, 2018, about $56 million in the fund. As any, I suppose, fund analyst might say, the bigger you get, perhaps the smaller your alpha becomes, the harder it is to invest that money. And you've experienced a relatively rapid increase in the amount of money that you're managing. Where do you see the opportunity for EGP for your business, say, in 5 years or 10 years from now?
So we're running 56 or just probably you've had a good month, maybe more like 57 or so million now. We intend to close the fund when we get to 100 million. And that's not because I think that $100 million is the extent of how well I can run money and still earn outperformance, but it gives me a long runway. So I sort of hope to run this business for the next 30 or 40 years, depending on health and, you know, obviously how well the brain stays working. But if you think about that rate of compounding that I talked about there, if you can compound that money over 20 or 30 years at a double-digit rate of return, it very quickly becomes a very, very large amount of money. So if we were to compound it for 30 or 40 years at 15% per annum, it would become many, many billions of dollars. So the reason why I've picked $100 million to close the fund off is to ensure that it's at least 10 or 20 years away before I encounter an issue whereby the amount of money we manage is impeding our ability to earn returns. So by closing at 100, I think I leave myself at least a decade or two, unless performance is really spectacular, before size becomes an issue.
I read in your most recent annual letter, which is the Zero Fee Manifesto, and the potential for EGP to launch more funds in the future.
Well, it's one of the reasons that I reopened fund. We were originally intending to close the fund when it got to $50 million, and then to slowly grow it to 100 only with the existing investors adding. But I've decided that we want to bring forward, we've got a stable of potential zero fee fund managers that are very keen to go, but I need to get my business to the point where it's closed and where I can I don't have to worry about raising money or dealing with new investors or any of that before we can start to really launch that next phase of the business. But you know, my hope is that, well, as I said in the annual letter, I hope to use the decade of the 2020s to introduce lots of new zero fee fund managers to market, and to really bring this idea, make it more of an industry standard. I would like to be, this will sound arrogant or overly ambitious, but to be thought of in 30 or 40 years time in much the same way that Jack Bogle is thought of in the ETF industry, in that he took that, he's a big reason why costs are still far too high in the fund management industry, but they're a lot lower as a consequence of the exchange traded fund and the indexing revolution.
That's another thing that you touched on in the annual letter, that there's a potentially insidious fallout from this dramatic shift we're seeing towards passive. Can you comment on what you wrote in the letter?
Yeah, well, so what I indicated, there was a thought experiment in the letter about what happens once passive ownership gets to the point where it's as much as 90% or more of individual companies, is that price discovery becomes very difficult in that situation. So the amount of active management that's there to enable price discovery becomes small, and it'll end up causing harm to capitalism, which is a system that I deeply love. That's, as I always say, has brought through my lifetime brought many billions of people out of poverty. But capitalism can be broken if capital isn't properly and effectively allocated to the best and brightest ideas. And indexing, if we're not careful, presents a real risk that capital gets allocated blindly, not to the best ideas, but just to the largest ideas.
And you went another step and said that it could actually have an effect on the Australian economy. Well, you put it in those terms.
Well, I again used an experiment to sort of think about the size of the total amount of equity investment in Australia and the total amount of active management. And I also talked about, when we say that 80% of managed funds underperform after fees and costs, because fees and costs are fairly high, I suggest that if you can roughly halve the fees and costs, that 80% that underperform could potentially be lowered to 40%, which would be good. But what they would also do, if you can remove the people who aren't capable of delivering a sufficient amount of alpha to cover their fees and costs, if you can take those people, and what I said in the letter is that these are good and smart people, well educated. If you can take them and redirect their efforts to more productive pursuits for the economy, then ultimately we all benefit. You know, these people could go back to being scientists and doctors and, you know, working on building infrastructure and technology rather than just clipping fees and doing a second-rate job managing money.
Indeed. I think it would be great to, if people wanted to learn more about you, to get onto your blog and read. Is there any other way that people can find you and
learn more
about your investing?
We're a very small business, so go to the website, the EGP Capital website, and without too much trouble, you'll find probably my email address or my mobile phone number, and give me a call, and I'm happy to talk investing. I love it.
Great. Okay, final question. If you had a time machine and you could go back to the younger Tony, what's one thing that you would tell yourself?
I thought about this question a bit, and it's a little bit hard to answer. I think that one of the things that I have been very fortunate about is that my particular personality is very suited to the world that we live in terms of, I just think everyone's got something that they're good at, and so saving and making money was probably always my thing. But you know, I can't think of anything that I would really change about what I've done or anything. You know, I often say this to friends and family. If you'd have asked me at 20 what sort of life I would have, I'm 41 now. What sort of life as a 41-year-old man I would have? I couldn't have created a better life than the one I've got. To be fair, so there's literally nothing that I would change. I sort of feel like I went down a path that just really suited my personality and who I am.
That's fantastic. One thing I've taken away from this meeting is that if we can underspend from a very young age, compound.
Well, everyone needs to think about a mechanism that they can use that suits their own personality. So for me, because I understood compounding, as I said, as a 30-year-old man, I used to think of a dollar spent as $1,000 I wouldn't have at 80. And I have some charitable goals that I want to achieve in life. So that making sure that money piled up at the back end of my life was very important to me. But for different people, you need to think about your own way of how to do that. And everyone's got their own strengths and weaknesses. I've got a bunch of my cousins that are builders, and I often say to them, they say, oh, you're just lucky to understand financial markets and it's easier for you. But I say, you've got advantages that I don't have. You know, you can buy or you can own a house, and you can do renovations, and everyone's got skill sets that can help them to live more comfortably. And if you just think about the things you're good at and exploit them, then you'll probably find that you can do that yourself.
Some great insights, Tony. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest, or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.